Welcome to Earth2.net, the show, episode 1151. Back, everyone. It is October, so once again, you know, me and we're doing like what we usually do every October. This is Will, and as always, I'm being joined by
Skylar Queen.
How's it going, Skylar?
I'm okay. How are you?
All right. I've had the last week off. I've started watching, you know, a ton of scary movies, so, you know, I'm just chilling with the season.
That's fair. This season, I don't know if it's necessarily very Halloween-y, and it'll carry over into November, but I'm very excited about the fact that a local cinema, my favorite cinema for all my friends and I in Toronto, where my friend Anthony hosts screenings every month. This month, they got the rights to play season 3 of Twin Peaks theatrically, and so I'm riding that high because I've seen today episodes 4, 5, and 6. I've got 7, 8, and 9 coming up, and I have a ticket to that, and I also have a ticket to the last 3 episodes. If I can figure out some like other ways to possibly schedule time and money, if I can get the others, that would be fun, but I'm just so excited to like live in that world in a theatrical setting. It's so much fun.
Nice.
I don't know, like, are you a Twin Peaks person?
I have watched the first season. And I have watched Fire Walk With Me so many times. I've always meant to watch The Return, but I just never got around to it. And the second season, I know, is divisive.
I mean, the second half of the second season. Because, like, the beginning, like, you've got the end of the mystery, and that's important, and all of that. And, I mean, there are moments, all the Black Lodge stuff is certainly important, but then you also have James's tryst with this random woman, the Englishman who's courting Lucy, and all sorts of silliness that just doesn't really matter. Oh my god, the Ben Horn's Confederate fantasy. There's a lot of weird stuff in season 2.
The other thing I remember is Joan Chen getting stuck in a bedpost.
Kind of a knob of like a nightstand, mm-hmm. I believe.
Do they ever resolve that in the Return?
I don't believe so. I am new to Twin Peaks myself. I've seen the ABC years, and Fire Walk With Me a few times. When I went to see Fire Walk With Me, actually, at 35, back on Twin Peaks Day, I was dressed as the log lady.
I remember.
I don't know if our audience has necessarily seen that picture, but I'm not delved into The Return yet beyond the episodes that I've watched recently. Actually, preparing for the theatrical screenings, I watched the first three episodes. I had to restart it, though, because I had the settings wrong. I didn't realize it until about 6 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes into the show. Because I was watching it in Italian. and the subtitles were still, for the Black Lodge parts, were still in English. But when you're into, like, oh, here's Dr. Jacoby getting a shipment of shovels, and it's like, well, why is he speaking Italian? Oh, there's an issue here. Okay, I'll restart.
Okay, that's hilarious.
The fact that I could have just, like, continued on for that long is really kind of funny, though. Like, but it's like, oh yeah, well, it's David Lynch. Of course, that would make sense.
The entire series is in Italian.
Why not?
Everyone just had to learn their lines phonetically.
Sure. I mean, the backwardsy stuff, that makes some sense. But in regards to the rest of the Halloween season, I have an idea for a costume. I hope it comes together. Nothing crazy this year because I need to be tight. But, you know, who isn't right now? And not really sure what I'm going to do through the holiday yet, but still excited for it nonetheless. Yeah.
Yeah, I know I'm having friends over to watch Halloween movies at the end of the month. Mind you, by the time everyone's listening to this, that's probably already happened. But, you know, it's like just, you know, just coming up with some fun films, some terrible films. Yeah, my highlights so far this season, as of like when we're recording, is I watched a film called Bloodhook.
Oh, is that recently come out?
Nope, it's from the 80s.
Oh.
And the entire...
Maybe I think there's another film that came out, like, this weekend or something that had a similar type of...
Yeah, it's directed by Jim Mallon, who is one of the producers on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
I remember his Flash cartoons.
Yeah, and, But yeah, the entire premise is a bunch of people go to a lake for a fishing contest, and they start getting murdered by an off-screen assailant who has this giant freaking fish fishing lure that starts, like, he kills people with it, or it's hilarious. But it's actually weirdly good, which is the strange part.
Yeah. Okay, well, I may look into it at some point, someday, if I remember.
Yeah.
With other films, anything else jumping out for the Halloween season?
You know, I'll probably go and I missed Weapons when it was in theater, so I'm kind of hoping, like, that... that it comes to HBO this month. If not, then I might see about actually spending an absurd amount of money to rent it.
I mean, it's still playing around here, but I know that it's not the case everywhere.
Yeah, by the time I was going to go and see it, it was only playing at like 9:20 p.m. in the evening. Yeah. Who knows, maybe they'll re-expand because, you know, the spooky season and there aren't that many horror films coming to theaters. But yeah, outside of that, like we usually do every time we do these, this falls like about a month after TIFF, so the Toronto International Film Festival. So Skylar, how was that?
This was a low key year for me, but I enjoyed myself. I saw Scarlett, the new film from the director of Belle and Digimon Adventure. The first two Digimon movies, really, technically, if you're going by, like, the short film and, like, the 45-minute second movie, which are parts of the Digimon the movie that the Saban and Fox people put together, and would have added a whole bunch of ska to. So, a lot of Bell is very similar to that second Digimon movie that he did, but he's also did a film for Wolf Children and a lot of other great work. And I enjoyed Scarlet. Some friends were disappointed in it, but it's also it kind of got like not even hints, but a large helping of Hamlet to it, which I was not prepared for necessarily, but I thought it was kind of fun. And there was, it's got a cel shaded, CG anime style, which, I was not prepared for. Because normally they'll do, hand drawn stuff. And I don't normally like cel shaded CG. I've still not seen the Battle of the Super Sons, which came out a few years ago. Because I saw a clip of like Clark talking to John, and I'm just like, "Oof, this doesn't look like it's for me."
It was
okay. I think a lot of it has to do with budget, because like when Dragon Ball went to cel shaded CG for Dragon Ball Super Superhero, that looks terrific during action scenes, but when it's going into like lower, like, smaller moments, then it looks kind of Uncanny Valley weird. And I didn't have those feelings with Scarlet. I think that might be to do with the budget, but I don't know for sure. But yeah, that I assume will be coming out around Christmas time in North America. It's Sony Pictures Classics who picked it up, so that'll be coming. Speaking of Hamlet, though, I also saw Hamnet, the new film
Jesse Buckley.
Well, yes.
Sorry.
She's the main character of the feature. I was thinking, what's Paul Menskell's name? But it's that. Jesse Buckley, I have seen in another film many years ago at TIFF. She was in a film called Wild Rose about someone in the UK who wanted to be a country singer. And she really hated when people would call it country and western music. She's like, don't call it country and western. Yeah. But
yeah, I have seen that. It was a pretty good film.
But Hamnet is a fictionalized film about Mrs. Shakespeare, but they do not call her Anne Hathaway. I assume that would be because it would probably be a distraction nowadays.
Yeah, a little.
But yeah, that's a lovely film. I enjoyed it very much. And I did see Wake Up Dead Man, which is, of course, the new Knives Out picture. It's just as wonderful as you would expect. I would say it is my least favorite of the three at this moment, but even still, it's a spectacular film. Not to bring up, just the fact that other friends of mine have seen it. Some of them have said they're their favorite. So, you know, your mileage may vary, but even still, great film, no matter where on the spectrum of where you might place it, it might be.
Yeah, I am hoping to actually, see it in the theater around here, because I know Netflix is supposed to be releasing it to theaters very limited. I know that, my regular theater didn't have Glass Onion, but it did. But another one in the area did. So I'm hoping something similar works out. I'm just kind of being cautious because I know the Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein is supposed to be playing later this month, but so far I'm not seeing any theaters in my area that have it. The closest one is in freaking Indiana, and I'm not driving to Indiana to see a film, but.
No, I mean, I still haven't seen Frankenstein. It is playing at the theater that the TIFF people own, the TIFF Lightbox, on 35, actually, so that'd be nice, but I don't know when I'll see it, so I hope I'll get a chance to. I assume it'll be around at that theater for a while, but in regards to, like, movies that aren't Guillermo's, that becomes a little bit more dicey about, like, when and if we'll get them. And fingers crossed, but... Oh, and I did 1, 2, 3. Yeah, that was all the films we took this year.
Eh, I mean, sometimes it's about the quality, not the quantity.
True.
I got a good story. Yeah, it's about a campus serial killer who murders 8 students.
Urban legends.
They had this, like, creature on the wing of the plane.
We've all told them.
True story, right?
We've all heard them.
You're going down.
Oh, God. Ready?
Cut! This is no Jamie Lee Curtis, right?
But these students are daring.
Urban Legends, scene 6, take 2.
To film them.
The movie is about a serial killer whose murders are all based on urban legends.
That's pretty cool.
There's this girl. She puts her hand down. And if her dog licks her hand, she knows everything's okay.
Can I be the dog? Because I'm a great licker.
It's an urban legend.
Like that girl who eats a burrito with a pregnant roach and all the eggs hatch inside of her nose.
No.
It's a tradition during finals week at the stroke of midnight. Everyone screams.
Someone is turning legends.
But at the same time, a co-ed is brutally attacked.
Into reality.
Dude, that looks so real.
Not enough blood.
You don't think it was real?
OJ left more blood than that on the Bronco.
Paranoia. Wrong man accused. How the lines blur between fantasy and reality.
Gotcha.
She's one hell of an actress, ain't she?
Whoever's doing this is gonna come after you again. Trust me.
Just an urban legend.
Urban legend, my ass.
Final cut.
You ever hear the urban legend about the guy who picks up the dead hitchhiker?
Okay then, well, so this year we are talking about Urban Legends Final Cut, because last year we talked about Urban Legends. Oh.
We're not talking about One Missed Call?
Oh, you actually had me going there for a second. Of like, did I somehow watch a completely different movie called Final Cut?
No. For the audience, Will did recently watch One Missed Call. And what did you think of that film?
Oh, I fucking hated it.
I've never seen it, but it was funny to see your review.
Like, I should not have been as annoyed with that film as I was, but, like, it literally took me watching it in, like, 20 or 30 minute segments instead of watching it just straight through. And this is a movie that's less than an hour and a half long. The fact that I couldn't be bothered to watch it all in one sitting should tell you just about everything you need to know about the film.
That's fair.
Like, even Ray Wise couldn't make it good. Oh. But yeah, we are talking about Urban Legend Final Cut, which was released in 2000. It is a sequel to the original Urban Legend, though. It only shares, like, a couple of characters, and other than that, like, it's mainly just... It kind of shares the premise to some extent, but sometimes it doesn't really keep to it. It was directed by John Ottman. This was his only film he has ever directed, though you will more know him as he's done music for a lot of films. He was also the editor for most of fucking Bryan Singer's movies. And yes, you can hear that disdain there, including the editor on freaking Bohemian Rhapsody, which...
God. The Academy Award-winning editor of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
Yes, John Ottman has a long and distinguished career with some interesting spots here and there. I mean, before we even get into the synopsis, there is a point in the commentary, and it's an old commentary, but John Ottman does mention when Captain Pike is screaming at people, some people think that this character is based on my friend Bryan Singer. But no, he's not like that.
But yeah, it was written by Paul Harris Boardman and Scott Derrickson, who both worked on Exorcism of Emily Rose. And in addition, Derrickson ended up doing both Doctor Strange, Black Phone, and Sinister. And then Paul Harris Boardman actually did one of the rewrites on Scream 4 that didn't get credited. So anyway, film came out in 2000, ended up, didn't do as good at the box office. So when we finally got a sequel to Urban Legend, it went straight to DVD, and also has... The third one has nothing to do with the first two films.
However, this film did get to number one at the box office, which the first one didn't.
Yeah.
Peaks and valleys, I suppose. It didn't do as well overall, but they had a little success early on.
Yeah. I know I didn't see it in theaters. I want to say I saw it probably shortly after it came out on DVD. Mm.
I would have not been allowed to yet. I don't think I would have been interested as well. You know what? Actually, bringing this back to the Tilt Talk, this movie opened about 2 weeks before the American cut of Digimon the Movie. So I did see that in theaters, and I also saw Bedazzled, which was coming out around the same time, the remake with Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, I know I didn't see either of those in theaters. Like, I know, but mind you, I bought, like, the Discotech release of Digimon the Movie that they came out with last year, and yeah, Discotech does great work. Yeah, there is a Blu-ray of Urban Legend Final Cut that's Shot Factory put out. It's not bad. It has deleted scenes that I might mention briefly, but and it has commentary, and it has but that's about it.
It does have everything that is available on the DVD that Sony put out back in the day. Not too much in the way of new updates. Something, but not a lot of things. I don't have that Blu-ray, unfortunately, so I can't go off of all of those extras. A lot of other research had to be done for this. Mm-hmm. But we will make do.
And like the last one, this was shot in Canada.
Yes, predominantly Toronto. The campus is in Peterborough. They wanted a different look, but still close by. So it is, like, as I said, not the same campus as last year, but there are certain parts of the movie that are very, like, distinctly, oh, I know where this is and I know where that is. There comes a point in the movie where I could see street signs and I was just like, okay, now where is this specifically? And I'll point that out later, and I lost about 90 minutes of my night just trying to find the damn street. Oh well.
See, I'm lucky that no one ever shoots movies in Dayton, because, yeah, I'm never going to bother looking up, oh, well, that's the street that was on.
Well, I don't know if anybody really cares enough to be like, oh my God, Travis Stark lived on this street, but I know where it is.
Yeah. Like, if I lived up in Cleveland, I would probably have, I'd probably spend half the time watching Superman to figure out, okay, so where is this in the city?
Mm. That's fair. I did see Superman a few times this summer.
A few times?
17.
Okay. Just so we're clear what a few constitutes. Okay, then. Unless there's something else we want to talk about, let's jump right into the synopsis. I'm going to warn everyone, this is going to be a based off of previous times, I usually, you know, have a lot of beats, and then before we break things up, I didn't do that this time, because if I'm being 100% honest, a lot of it would have just been, okay, cool, this stuff happens, I don't really have anything to say about this. So, just being completely honest with everyone here.
Okay. Well, at the very beginning, before we even get to something that really needs to be synopsized, the film starts with references to other movies before it really even starts, because the letters of Urban Legends and then eventually Final Cut are showing up individually as if a nod to Alien. Mm-hmm. Although it does say UL2 before the S swaps around, which is like, that's a little weird and wacky, but there are a lot of references to movies there, and I can't say it really reads very well, like, as like, for that particular one, it's like, oh yeah, this is totally a reference, but it's like, okay, yep, the letters are coming in little by little.
Okay. So, the film opens on a plane flying. Everyone is wearing lace. A blonde woman, Sandra, played by Legally Blonde 2's Red, White, and Blonde's Jessica Caulfield, goes to bang her boyfriend in the bathroom. The flight is experiencing turbulence. There's a letter in blood on the mirror that says, "You're going down." Sandra leaves to see a flight attendant killing everyone, including the pilots. Sandra gets in the pilot seat, only it was actually a movie set. We thankfully meet most of our cast of film students, including director Toby, played by Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness's Anson Mount, boom mic operator on Vanessa, played by Too Fast, Too Furious's Ava Mendez, sound woman Amy, played by Star Trek Into Darkness's Jennifer Morrison, producer Graham, played by Troy 2, Pandora's Box's Joey Lawrence, PA Kevin, played by Resident Evil Apocalypse's Derek Asland, and special effects guys Stan and Dirk, played by Scream 4's Anthony Anderson and the writer of 22 Jump Street, Michael Bacall. They continue shooting.
My actual note for Joey Lawrence is whoa. So I'm glad you got there. I'm very excited that Jessica Caulfield?
Yeah, something like that.
I just wrote her down as Margot because she's Margot in Legally Blonde. I'm very excited whenever she shows up. I think she's great in this. I've not seen Valentine, but I hear she's good in that as well. Eva Mendes is nice to see her in general. Okay, so Sandra's acting is put into question throughout the feature, but I think it gets worse once you realize it's like, oh, this is a movie. But like throughout the rest of the scene, it's fine, but she's like in later scenes in the movie of like, oh my God, she's the worst actress ever. She's like doing judo to nothing. And it's just like, well, yeah, now, but that's not what she was doing before.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like that's a little silly. Also, just like the way that they shot the "You're Going Down" is just like, I realize that this is a movie within a movie, and the characters are also supposed to be dumb, but it's just like, you want to shoot that differently because you see that message far too long before she notices it. And that hurts me.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that her boyfriend, quote unquote, in the scenes is Yanni Gelman, who was in the Lizzie McGuire movie.
Hello!
Yep.
Yes, this is what dreams are made of.
And also Jason X.
Yeah, but I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was another movie I did see in theaters, actually. I saw that with my dad.
Yeah. There's also a kind of geeky guy on the plane who's that I didn't mention the synopsis, who's played by Chuck Campbell, who was also in Jason X.
So, yeah, he annoyed me just because, like, I realize there is a Twilight Zone movie, but it's weird to be referring to the Twilight Zone movie and say, like, hey, this is, like, that movie. Like, you would just say Twilight Zone, because, like, that one segment from the Twilight Zone has been done on most versions of the Twilight Zone, be it the Rod Serling version, the movie, the radio show. I think they did a variation on it with Jordan Peele, and I think I saw that episode and it didn't really work that well. But it was a similar thing. Every time that they do the Twilight Zone, they do that story over again. Mm-hmm. It irked me. I don't know.
I swear there was something on the side of, the plane. The same thing happened to me.
Yes. That's a very good, for people who aren't aware of that reference. When William Shatner guest starred on Third Rock from the Sun, they mentioned the fact that the both of them had done that story in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, but, I mean, honestly, like, Sandra's acting, I think, is just, you know, she's improvising, which probably shouldn't be doing, but at the same, especially since they're working on actual film stock, it's costing money.
Yeah. Oh, he does say, the director character, Toby, I believe, tells Sandra, get it right or I'll kill you, which I felt seemed like we were suddenly on the set of Art Huckabee's. I don't know if you're aware of David O. Russell's directing style.
I know that Lily Tomlin just did not care for the man.
Yeah. There's footage of her giving him the finger while setting up a shot, and not in a playful manner. Also, How are you mean to Lily Tomlin? She's America's treasure.
Yeah. I mean, they apparently have made up, or at least, you know, they are civil to each other.
Okay.
Based off of a couple of interviews that she gave.
Okay. I was unaware of that, but still.
Yeah.
I don't care for the man.
But my main thing with, like, how this opening is set up is, okay, so basically, most of the beginning of the film, it's a fake out. But when you actually see the outside of the plane set, you only see the pilot section. You don't see, like, the back part of it at all. So why are we seeing all these extra shots happening before, like, the reveal happens?
Well,
outside, you know, it being a fake out.
Yeah, there are cuts that wouldn't have made sense from that. There are so many extras that wouldn't have been there for, like, the kind of budget that they're really working with. there's a lot that doesn't really make sense. Like, once the reveal happens, but
yeah, There's a, yeah, we'll get into this. There's a lot that doesn't make sense. And basically, we get our entire cast reveal in, the entire cast, for the most part, gets introduced here, which I'm so thankful for, because seriously, like, if I had realized, you know, my entire casting gag thing would, I'd still be doing at this point, I'd probably slap past me, because Jesus Christ, it took a while to figure out, what am I doing? Sequels. We're doing sequels this time. Okay. Which, in a couple cases, was very hard, because, I mean, in the case of Michael Bacall, like, he doesn't do a lot of acting, so I was like, okay, well, he wrote 22 Jump Street. I technically probably could have done the Scott Pilgrim movie, which, the Scott Pilgrim TV show.
Oh, was he involved in the show?
He did the voicing on one of Envy's groupies.
Oh. That's coming to Blu-ray this Christmas. I'm very excited.
I didn't realize that was happening. Okay, yeah, I'm buying.
Yes.
I will always support physical media of something I enjoy, and I really enjoyed that, so.
Well, Ben David, I can't remember his last name, but the co-showrunner with Brian Malley have announced, like, a couple of days ago, they also recorded commentary for every episode, so there will be extras on this as well. So, yay!
Oh, nice. I wonder if they're going to include the table reading of the script of the original movie.
Unlikely, but I would have I would find that fun.
But yeah. One last thing before I move on. So, okay. So, technically, like, when Sandra is and her boyfriend are in the bathroom and he's, you know, he's eating her out, is that technically a mid-flight snack or a box lunch? and Skylar just shook his head at me. So, the next day, dawn breaks on generic film school, aka Alpine University.
Okay, that's not a generic-looking school.
I'm saying generic film school because literally, unless you're paying attention to, like, decals, you never know the name. Nobody ever actually says the name of the school out loud.
I see. Okay. I thought you were talking about, like, the design. And, like,
no.
It's an odd thing. The architecture is very specific to that school. That's why I took umbrage with it. I'm sorry. Carry on.
Anyway, Amy is jogging the class. Get used to seeing Amy jogging and walking around this campus. The dean welcomes them back before film professor Solomon, played by Carrie 2013's Herb Boucher, welcomes them even more with even more exposition before expositioning about seniors getting to submit their thesis films for the Hitchcock Award. Later that night...
And 50K. Which is a very small amount of money, I'd assume. Like, I know now, but, like, it seems like less, but it's just like, is 50K really that much of, like, a wow, an award?
I mean, it's enough to get, assuming you get a roommate, probably enough to afford a year's rent in L.A., assuming you get a roommate and you don't care about the shithole you're living in.
Okay.
Was it 50K or 15K?
Now I'm not sure.
I can't remember either.
But either way, it seems small. Yeah. If it's 15, that's ludicrous.
The subtitle said 15K.
Okay, I might have misheard and then written it down wrong.
I heard it as 50K, yes. So I don't know.
If it is 15, indeed that is ludicrous.
Yeah. So
I mean, but if anyone wants to give me 15K,
thank
you.
I will gladly take 15K. Anyway, later that night, Amy is walking home when campus security guard Reese, still played by Loretta motherfucking Devine, picks her up to give her a ride home. She comments on being a fan of Pam Grier's coffee, including trimming her gun in gold. Amy wants to make movies, but is lacking in good stories. Reese then expositions about the original film, revealing she got fired from Pendleton and just barely got a job here. The next day, Amy tells Professor Solomon the idea of her thesis film, Serial Killer Killing People Using Urban Legends. Her family apparently worked in film. Professor Solomon is excited about the idea.
So, welcome back, Loretta Divine. Mm-hmm. The Divine Loretta. her expositioning about the first film. She does have weird numbers, though. So, she says that 8 students had been killed. It should be 9 if she is including faculty.
Yeah. There is one other idea I had, which is, this is no prize in this. That's, the no prize is that Brenda went back and killed Jared Leto and the other one after the end of the film.
Maybe? I don't know. She seemed like she was trying to lay low, but perhaps, I don't know.
I mean, maybe she just waited a couple days. They were having a great time, and then suddenly they ended up eating a chicken with a giant tumor that killed them. Yeah. Honestly, though, I mean, this movie being what it is, I'm not really surprised that they got that detail wrong. Or who knows, maybe Reese just is not remembering it very well.
She was going through a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she lost her job because she wasn't willing to go through with a cover-up. But, yeah, no. During the welcome back thing, which, mind you, I have never been to a freaking college that did a welcome back assembly, even in something like a very small major like film studies. Mm-hmm. But the entire idea there of literally just all of these different like professors getting introduced in the middle of the year.
Oh, right. Yeah, because I hope you have a nice holiday. They don't say what holiday, but...
I mean, there's snow all over the place during the film, with the exception of the occasional scene where there isn't.
Yes. That's, like, and they're wearing scarves and things. Mm-hmm. So it's just, like, I would assume it was, like holidays of, like, December-type wintery time, as opposed to, like, holiday being break. Of like summer holidays kind of thing, because yeah, it would make more sense to have that sort of like, these are who these people are if it were summer holidays that they had just had. But
I'll also add that I would totally watch a film series called Splattertown. But the one thing I find hilarious during all this, during this entire sequence, that was, so there is a point where right before Amy goes and gives all the like, well, here's the film I'm going to be making, there's another professor in the room and he's basically just droning on and it sounds like a freaking film textbook, like somebody just found a page from a film textbook and then transcribed it for the script, but also it is exactly the kind of thing you would expect the film professor to be droning on and on about.
I mean, yes and no. I've had different professors that are more interesting and less interesting about these sorts of things, but what is strange to me, though, is that, like, the school has the award and being named after Alfred Hitchcock, and like, yes, he's very well respected in that he could do other things beyond horror pictures and even thrillers. But for the most part, we're thought of, when we think Hitchcock now, we think of like Psycho and therefore horror. all the posters in that office are horror-themed posters as well. And they're making a horror movie in this movie, and Captain Pike is mad about, we'll get to a point where this happens, but like Captain Pike gets mad about, like, oh, you're also doing a horror movie. It's like, motherfucker, this seems like it's a horror school. Like, like, nobody seems to be addressing the fact that it is, but that seems to be the one prism of film that we're looking at. Like, sure, supposedly, like, her father was a documentarian, but, like, where are the film students who are making, like, the lesbian drama, or, like, the wacky comedy, and it's like, I don't know, like, there's a set piece at the end where it's like, oh, there's a sci-fi set.
Yeah.
But it's like, who's making that movie?
And there's also a set, another horror set, that's not related to either of the two people who are making a horror film, so.
Exactly!
Like, there's an entire, I feel like outside this weird little friend group, there's like there are people that just kind of look at that friend group and they're like, we're not touching them. They're the drama kids. We're just going to make our own movies over here.
Yes. That's true.
Yeah. So, at a bar, two people that we have never freaking seen before are drinking. Travis Stark, played by S. Darko's Matthew Davis, and Lisa, played by Bridget Jones, the Edge of Reason's Jacinda Barrett. Lisa apparently saved Travis's ass. What did she do? Who knows? Because her drink is drugged, and instead of catching her flight, she's kidnapped and taken to a shithole apartment where she wakes up in a bathtub full of ice, missing a kidney. A man in a rain slicker tries to get her. She calls 911, but the person on the other line hangs up on her because she thinks she's getting prank called. She tries to get out a window, but the killer drags her back in before beheading her with a broken window pane. Kill count one.
So, Travis, I have to rejigger some of this because, like, for a little while I was just writing one. But because the actor played Warner in Legally Blonde. I completely forgot he was in this film. So that I was just like, that was one of my notes there, was like, Warner! But this whole sequence was not in the script initially. So that's why you've never heard of this character whose kidney gets stolen. Because Travis becomes a big part of the film, and that it's good that you actually see him here, and honestly, more Captain Pike, because Toby was like many of the characters in this film, just kind of goes away for a long time. It's just like this movie is so many characters that don't get well defined. And it's like, oh yeah, you're here. You're still alive? Okay, they'll come back in 40 minutes or something. And it's just like, I don't understand this. But with this, this, I don't know when you would have introduced this character, who had her kidney stolen, elsewhere. Obviously they wanted to add another kill, because they had gotten a very long time without having any kills in this, horror film. But part of that reason initially was because John Ottman, didn't really like horror films and wanted it to be, kind of more of a suspense thriller. And, but I wanted to be cheeky with the vibe and all that, and he didn't want gore, and although he apparently was the one who added like the actual, like, I believe it was a goat kidney that they used as the kidney, being dead to their dog and stuff. And because by that point, he's like, all right, fine. You want more blood? I'll put some blood in this scene that we're adding at the last moment. But I don't really understand why they would have thought that, like, because honestly, I do like this film, and I'm gonna keep on saying that to myself, and hopefully I still believe it by the end. But there's so much of this film that just is underbaked or boring, and just like, without that scene, where would any of this go? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, this is obviously shoehorned in.
Yeah.
But because nobody will ever talk about Lisa again this entire movie.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where I think, like, later on we get, like, everyone that worked on Travis's film, like, on a screen briefly, and Lisa's not even in there.
No. Well,
because nobody ever knew Lisa. She never appeared before. She will never. But anyway, well, that's an entire other thing, though. I'll get to that. But the thing is, this is the best kill in the entire movie.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's the most engaging. It's the most suspenseful. There is a meanness there that's not there in the other parts. And now this scene was written by the guy who wrote the original film, because I guess Scott Derrickson and his writing partner were busy by this point. But I don't love the fact that we're reusing the kidney heist. And like, I understand, like, oh, well, we didn't get to see it in the first movie. It's like, yeah, but it's like, three quarters of the way there. It's like, but it, even still, like, the fact that we are, like, kind of reusing a moment doesn't matter, because the way that it is executed is very, very cool. This sequence also had another reference to another horror film. You've got, when she goes into, like a closet area, like where all the coats are. Someone has a plastic kind of coat bag that gets wrapped around their head, and that's referencing Black Christmas. I do think it is interesting to note, though, that this was filmed in '99. What was a popular show around that time that had drinking?
I know. Sex in the City.
And what was that? What was it that they were giving out, like candy, at that bar?
Cosmos.
Yes, they had a big plate of Cosmos that were already poured. Like, I don't know why the killer had like waited, just like, oh, these ones will be the ones for these people. Like, which, like, did he just not have enough? Roofie drug to roof, like, because they were just like out for a long time. You could have poured a bunch into all of them. I guess that, then you'd have like 30 people falling asleep at the bar. But yeah. Even still, there was just like an insane amount of Cosmos. I've never seen so many Cosmos in one place.
And the thing that confuses me there is, okay, so she's the only one that drinks. Both her and Travis's drinks were spiked, so
right.
I'm like, what was the killer playing a game? Both of them here at this point, but then that has further issues further on down the line. But was it just to make sure one of that no matter which one she drank, he was getting her? But I don't know.
I will say,
I'm trying to make logic to this film.
That's fair. I will also say the dog seemed kind of confused by the decapitation, and that amused me.
But then the dog gets a treat.
It's true.
So later, Amy tells Sandra about an urban legend about how no one heard somebody getting killed at midnight because everyone else was screaming. Elsewhere, Amy walks by various people editing. Travis is making some big, impressive film. She asks him to look at her script. Amy goes over the film with her crew. They're doing the one about the girl who uses her dog to help her in the dark, only to find the dog dead with people licked too on the mirror. Toby bursts in, mad that Amy is also doing a horror film. He says no one was stealing the Hitchcock from him and quits as her DP, director of photography. Later, I need to make sure to be specific there what DP is.
Well, the film doesn't.
But, it like, does not.
It doesn't assume that the non-film people will think of dirty things, so yeah. Why should we?
Later, Amy visits Travis's house. He got a C- on his film. He's getting drunk. He offers the DP from his film to her. Later, over an establishing shot of a bell tower, we hear a gunshot.
Travis, this was where, like, and I don't know if I should say, like, the actual intersection, but you can see in the film, it says here on a street, but I will say that it's about 45 minutes, from downtown, maybe about a 15 minute walk from Lee's Palace if we want to connect things back to Scott Pilgrim. but I do know where that house is. It does still look like that and has like the red trim under the kind of white, pillars and looks good.
Yeah. So, this is obviously where we were supposed to meet Travis in the film. Because, literally, she walks up, Travis is, like, editing in the editing room, and it's looking so impressive. We hear, like, a couple of the voices of a couple of his actors and everything. And everyone keeps on calling him Travis Scott. Full name, for no good reason, except for if you were introducing a character into your film.
Yeah. But people do like to say Travis Scott because you were, she also says of the girl with kidney also at the beginning of this, like, Travis Scott.
So a couple of the deleted scenes happened before this, one of which introduces like everyone like walking the class together. Like before that, before the assembly, which would have actually introduced here's who I am. Here's my personality. And then during that, they would have walked past Travis, who's working on his film, and Ava Mendez's character would have been like, go talk to him. I'm scared. But yeah, I mean, there's a few things here going on. We get a moment with the parkas from the first film.
Yeah, that is cute. I do like that. It's strange to me that they do try to have a killer look for this film, but it takes 46, I think, minutes to get to it. And I do like the look, but there's also no reason for it.
Yeah, the timeline is just really freaking wonky, though, because, okay, so Amy and Travis were supposed to meet up in a couple of days, so, you know, he could, because he was going to talk to her about her script and everything. And then he's editing his film then. He apparently got graded on his film in 2 days. So I don't know if he was putting the finishing touches, and then it was getting, if they were going to be making the final cut to it, and the final print, and then it was, he'd submit it to be graded, but even then, that seems like a really short amount of time to be grading what is apparently a full-length film, I'm guessing?
I mean,
based off of Amy's film, I'm assuming it's a full-length. But, yeah, the timeline gets wonky, though, when you get into, okay, so she's shooting the following day. I'll get into this in the next sequence, because that's where the real timeline wonkiness comes in, because it literally turns into, how long did it take them to notice somebody was dead? But anyway, also, maybe it's just this scene in particular, but is Toby wearing a wig?
I don't know.
Like, his hair just, something looks odd about his hair in a few of these scenes.
I don't know.
Okay, so on set, Sandra got an audition for ER that she will be heading out to shortly. As they start shooting, Simon, played by Marco Hofstadter, who has never been in a sequel except this one, arrives. He brought his own camera. Later, everyone leaves, though Sandra forgot her keys on set. As she searches, somebody starts filming, sneaking up on her. Later, the crew watches dailies before the film changes to Sandra being murdered. Everyone except Amy thinks it's part of the film. Kill count 2. No one can find the film reel. Toby comes by and informs them Travis is dead. Professor Solomon expositions that Travis killed himself. Amy sees a person that looks like Travis. Kill count 3.
So, Sandra's death reference, keeping Tom, but there is a guy in the screening room that is not in any of the other parts of the film. He is credited as Crony in the screening room. He is the guy who says, "Dude, looks so real," to Anthony Anderson. That man, is our, CanCon, icon of the moment, because he is the Canadian children's show host of that era, Pat Kelly. Now, Pat Kelly has done stuff with the Second City, had a comedy series on a channel that was at the time called The Comedy Network, that was kind of like an Onion News kind of show, and that was funny. But when I was a kid, he was one of like the program jockeys for YTV's The Zone. By that time they had stopped calling them PJs, but, I was very excited to see him. I don't know if he's still working, but, it was very exciting that he was there. He was also, in that time period, because YTV was, such a big thing, and you recall, like, now that's what I call music CDs and things of that nature.
Yeah.
So YTV had their own now style party mix CD, but for every one of those CDs that they would put out, that would be like with pop hits with like Britney and Will Smith and NSYNC, and then I like, here's the Pokemon theme, just to, because like, well, I have to put like a song that relates to one of the shows. There would also always be a song by the people who were hosts of The Zone at that time. So when I think of Pat Kelly, I think of Nuclear Donkey was the name that they gave the band that was just for these CDs. And I think he has only done like 3 of those songs before he had left program jockeying, but there is a song out there with Pat Kelly as one half of Nuclear Donkey singing Donkey Sneakers.
Okay.
It's a very strange song about putting on your shoes in the morning.
I mean, I just found him on like IMDb, and I'm like, okay, it's Carson, which in Twitches. Yes.
Okay, so yes, I've never seen Twitches, but that was like a big break for them.
Yeah, I have seen Twitches more than once.
Okay, but I would watch cartoons every day with him in between.
So this is the first time I think you don't get a good look at it, but I think this is the first time we see the fencing mask.
Okay, so, I thought there was a little, it is there, actually. And that's about 40 minutes in?
Yeah.
No, okay.
About 30, 40.
Yeah, it's, it doesn't make sense. Like, there's no, reason for it to be a fencing mask. Like, this school, despite it being a film school, they obviously have a rowing team of some sort. But we don't know if they have, like, a fencing department or something. There's no reason set up for why this mask. And I think it's a great look. The cloak is a bit like, there's not much to that, but it's just like, I would have liked there to be a reason, and I would have liked to have it earlier on in the film. But, it is really ballsy move though to make Madonna the, villain of your movie.
So, okay, no joke. First, when I saw the trailers for this, I didn't realize I'd never seen a fencing mask before.
Oh, really?
So I thought it was like, a microphone.
Oh, okay.
Like just a giant microphone helmet or something like that. I don't know. Mm. And then, okay. So eventually when I saw Die Another Day, I was like, oh, that makes sense. Never mind. Yeah, I will say though, this movie has some good moments of style. Like, I really the part in the screening room where it keeps on cutting between Amy's reactions to the film and just like close-ups of her eyes and then cuts to the actual murder, like, and Sandra getting chased, like, there is just, that is really well shot and edited. Like, that, I am going to just say that if the person who edited this had actually edited Bohemian Rhapsody, he might have earned the Oscar. But the fact that somehow he lost that in 18 years, just saying. But no, like, this, I mean, yeah, the thing, film has these weird moments where it's, like, evoking, like, kind of giallo style stuff, and it has the audacity to do that. I kind of have to give it a little bit of applause, even though then it goes in immediately, oh, Travis Stark got killed. Hey, so Travis Stark killed him. Yeah, Travis Stark got, committed suicide. Let's center this around ourselves, though.
Yeah, I do think it's kind of funny, like, to put, like, I realize that they're at a film school and, like, oh, he was in film school, he liked film, he was doing film, but it's like, who the fuck is going to put film reels up on their memorial? Like, it's happy as fuck. I'm so sorry to anyone who has had film reels at family or friends' memorials. I should probably not have said that was tacky. We might cut this.
Eh. Do you want me to cut it?
Eh.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Like, everything with Sandra's death really works. Like, I love the entire fact that, yeah, like you were saying before, like, just how wretched her acting is. Like, just... The fact that she just starts doing kung fu at the quote-unquote killer for no good reason, which...
Yeah.
Side note, the killer in Amy's film is apparently, you know, some guy in a pork pie hat.
Yes. They were big around that time again.
I guess. It's just some guy. He does not get any lines in the movie. He will never get any lines again.
There are so many people in this movie who have nothing to do. Even the people, like, Eva Mendez's character apparently has much more to do in the finished film than she had originally because they just liked her. What was she doing in the earlier drafts of that? Who the fuck knows? Because there's not much to give her in the final cut.
She was off doing lesbian things.
Oh.
Which, mind you, I love the fact that, you know, they just are like, cool, Vanessa's a lesbian. And that was like, yes, this is awesome. Here's her girlfriend. Can we give you a lift? You already have.
That was a dumb joke.
It was.
But I did like that he was so, like, pleased when she was like, yeah, I'd fuck you if you were a girl. And he's like, oh.
What can we say? The Swedes are cool with it.
I know Swedes. Well, not anymore, very well, but like I had a Swedish exchange student when I was a kid. We're still in contact with that family, but you know, I don't know her that well anymore.
But yeah, no, yeah, and Simon's hot. Later at a memorial, Amy and Graham talk. Turns out Amy's father died shooting nature documentaries. At night, Amy walks around campus, going to a part under construction. She walks into Travis's twin, Trevor, played by S. Darko's Matthew Davis. He's sure Travis was murdered and asks Amy to tell no one about him. Later on set, Amy records screaming as various people leave. Simon walks through campus in the dark when the killer beats him to death with a telescopic lens. Amy briefly hears him yelling for help, but when she runs out, finds no body. Kill count 4. Seeing security cameras, she runs to Reese's office where she's watching Foxy Brown and says, security cameras. Amy borrows the security tapes, sees Simon's murder, and then gets scared by the killer in a scary Mac Tonight mask. He stalks her through a music recording studio before escaping sans videotapes, which the killer takes. Amy runs away through the steam tunnels before running into Reese. Reese doesn't believe her.
Yeah, Reese is very quick to call this lady paranoid after the last movie.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, but also, you know, so much of the first film would have been prevented if you just believed the girl.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I do think that Travis's brother should have had big Maddie Ferguson glasses. And, like, he has such mildly different hair. It's like, I realized you're going to play later with the fact that I was like, oh, they're identical, but it's like, really, it's like, I have known identical twins. They still have, like, slightly different hair or, like, something.
Yeah, and
more than he has here.
And since he is supposed to be the one that's a little bit more, that's a little less put together, like, maybe even just have him dressed a lot less nicely than Trevor was. Or Travis.
Exactly.
Whichever. Doesn't really matter.
Other one.
The other
the
one.
The dead one.
Yeah. And instead, it's just like, oh yeah, no, like, you dress exactly the same. You have nearly the same haircut. You aren't in constant contact with each other, so that's just an amazing coincidence, sure.
Yeah. I don't know.
The thing about this film as well is everyone becomes an asshole in the back half of the film. Because, so, I mean, Toby was always an asshole, but Graham out of nowhere is suddenly just, like, being a dick to Amy for no good reason except for, you need this as much as I do.
Yeah.
You need to succeed. And he's apparently going to college to become a film producer? Is that something they offer courses in?
I don't know. I've not seen a producing course, but I'm sure that, like, I mean, Scott Mosier went to film school.
Fair. But even then, like, it's just, like, so much of this is, so much of his character is just, I am going to be antagonistic, and I am here in the background.
Well, and all of the characters are, have, like, little hints of mild sexism here and there. And, like, I don't doubt that that would be prevalent in, well, anything, really. I was just going to say film school, particularly in that era, but, like, most places are sexist to this day in North America. But I don't know, it just, like, just the way that it was peppered in just felt weird. Like, there, I don't know. I don't think it was handled in a, I don't want to say delicate way, but, like, in a truthful way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah.
The other thing that I find interesting is the school is very selective about where it has cameras.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have one in this random stretch between buildings. You have one in the steam tunnels, but you don't have any, like, in the hallways around this one building. And you don't have it down by the random-ass boathouse. Mm-hmm. That's also connected to the steam tunnels somehow. Yeah, they're honestly, like, this entire sequence, I mean, Amy catches the Simon screaming for help through the microphone somehow. Mm-hmm. But doesn't hear him while the actual scream's happening. But I saw the outside of those buildings. The walls can't be that thin. Like, unless a window's open. But it's also winter, so why would you have a window open?
I don't know. Places can get warm.
Fair, and they are shooting, so they have to have lights up, have specific lights up, so yeah. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
While they were filming Gingersnaps, that whole movie was apparently night for day, so that would have been a very, very warm set, I would assume.
I still haven't seen Gingersnaps.
Really? Oh, I would have thought you had.
I need to get around to it.
I haven't seen the sequels, but I very much like the first one.
Okay, so later, Amy meets up with Travis. He believes her. Trevor used to get in trouble, so that's why he doesn't want the cops to be involved. Amy wanted to make her film to do something of her own to make her dad proud. Amy realizes this is probably about the Hitchcock, and Trevor says he'll stake out their shoot tonight. Tonight scene, the Tunnel of Terror, where the bodies are real. They're using an old mine ride. Stan and Dirk set up special effects. Amy sends everyone else away. While Amy surveys the ride, the killer first electrocutes Stan, kill count 5, then chases down Dirk, electrocuting him also, kill count 6. Amy finds their bodies and then hides from the killer. She runs into Reese. They call the cops, who write it off as an accident.
So this feels very My Bloody Valentine to me, with it being a mine thing. But with it also being, like, an amusement ride, I'm not sure if they were also being inspired in some way by the Knott's Berry Farm calico mines ride. That's a much more big and expansive and, frankly, impressive ride. But I don't know, it would have been around for decades upon decades at that time already, so I don't know.
So apparently this was shot at Ontario Place.
The ride itself was called Wilderness Adventure, and there's a lot of, if you go on to like YouTube and stuff, there's a lot of like urban explorers who have gone through in not most recent years, because like much of Ontario Place that was actually an amusement park has been leveled completely by now. But it's really a big point of contention with Torontonians and even other people throughout the province, because the province owns Ontario Place. But at a certain point, they decided that it wouldn't be an amusement park anymore, and then it has just been an open wound for a long time. And then, with the current government of Rob Ford's brother, Doug, he is the current premier of Ontario, and he has been desperately trying to put in luxury spas and casinos. The spa seems like it might be going in, but other people have been at least able to get a large section of the property to be a public park, a very large sized one, but it's really quite a mess right now. It's also home to another thing that has been closed for a good 5 years or more, is the Cinesphere, which has the first ever permanent IMAX screen. So there's a lot of like history and culture to that area that is just being decimated. And it's not to stand up in my soapbox for too long, but this town.
Fair enough. This town, only literally the entire country right now for me.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah. But what I was getting at was, so apparently the mine ride was actually a log ride that they had drained the water from for the off season.
Yes, that is true. And you can kind of tell in certain areas the way that it looks. It like they try to hide it and put in some track, but it certainly looks like it is designed for a different sort of ride than it is.
Yeah. Like, I think my point of contention here is, for liability reasons, no theme park is letting somebody use one of their rides in a film without, you know, somebody being there to basically supervise them. Like, right. Letting somebody else run the ride is, if they get injured, the park is getting sued.
Yeah.
Which, mind you, two people get electrocuted and die in what the police call an accident, so they're still getting sued no matter what. But, you know, if you had somebody on set to see, oh yeah, no, that was a killer, we can't be sued for this.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Which, mind you, still brings up the question, what was Reese doing there? She's a campus cop. How'd she even know they were there?
Huh. Well, she says, like, how are things going? Perhaps there was a scene that might have been deleted or just off screen. She was saying, like, oh yeah, for my film tonight, I was going to do this at this place. And she was like, oh, I'll come visit when I'm off my shift or something. I don't know.
They should have just randomly had her in the scene where Vanessa and Amy were going over it while Professor Solomon was there, because, you know, then, you know, mm-hmm. everyone that apparently needs to know that where they're shooting is there.
That's true.
Being ahead of ourselves there, but whatever. Like I said before, half this film is just Amy running or walking around the trails around campus.
Yeah.
Like, you could cut out, if you cut out all of that, I swear you probably save about 5 or 10 minutes of film. Like, this is David Decoteau levels of padding. Also, I'd never heard of that urban legend before. Like, going back, I was like, that doesn't even sound like something, that doesn't sound like anything real, but apparently it is, so. Well, not, it didn't really happen, it's an actual urban legend. So, later, Amy meets up with Trevor. Trevor says he was following Graham. Trevor says she needs to rest, and then they'll go back to the tower. So, they bang. Trevor has a perky ass, and then he stabs her. But it was a dream. So, maybe his perky ass is also a dream. Who knows? Amy wakes up alone, but sees a light in the clock tower. Upon investigating, she finds Vanessa, who got a forged note. They run up the clock tower from the killer. They hide in the closet, only for the killer to find them and pull out Vanessa. The closet also has Simon and Sandra's bodies. When she gets out, Vanessa is dead, hanging from the bell tower. Kill count 7. She runs out, finds Trevor, Reese sees her running out.
She, like, I realize that it is the sex dream and all that, but, like, she is very close to this man she met on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Like, yes, he looks like a man that you liked, but what the hell, man?
Yeah. You barely even knew that guy that you liked.
Well, yeah.
And also the facial expressions during it, they look so freaking bored. It's like literally like they're going to talk about, oh, so I had some toast this morning. Oh, you did. That's nice.
The sex dream itself is interesting because also the knife that he goes to stab her with in the dream isn't like a, like, it's not like a movie knife. It's like it looks like a steak knife or something.
Yeah.
Just like, I don't know. It just didn't seem so scary to me. It just, like, there was like a serrated edge to it, but it seemed fairly small. It was just like, oh, do you want a baked potato? Or it's like,
yeah, you know, you can't. You come to Outback Stab House, you apparently get to leave with a knife. But yeah, you know, and then she just happens to look outside and sees the lights on the bell tower at that moment. Like, what was the killer planning if she didn't?
She would, someone would have to get like a megaphone to just like start playing "There's a Light" over at the Frankenstein place, and be like, "Oh,
hey." Yeah. I will say the fact that Vanessa's note is obvious. The fake note obviously says something along the lines of "I'm in lesbians with you." And honestly, going back and when you watch some of the scenes, there are very much hints of Vanessa having a thing for Amy leading up to this. So it's like, you know, it's a nice little payoff, because otherwise Vanessa's pretty much there to be yet another red herring.
Yeah.
Because this film loves making you think everyone could be the killer.
Yeah.
At any given point. And, you know, they are very forward in remembering that the first film had a woman killer, so having Vanessa as that possible red herring, you know, hey, there's a version of this movie where she pulls off a good Brenda.
She turns around in a very Bondian chair way. It's just like, I want her to be stroking a cat rather than just holding that note.
Do you expect me to die? No, miss. Do you expect me to talk? No. No, Amy, I expect you to lesbians. and also, literally, the killer, you know, pulls her out of the closet. That said, so because this movie likes to give us good things, only to then rip them away from us. The part where Amy is locked in the closet and then finds Simon and Sandra's bodies. Jesus Christ, those brats coming out of Sandra's neck.
That was a good effect. It was a great effect, but it's also like, she apparently they were very nice rats, and she was like cuddling up with them at times.
Which, though, mind you, also brings up the question: did this bell tower already have rats, or did the killer import them?
I assume it must have already.
Yeah. I mean, it's just lucky, though, for Vanessa that instead of, you know, putting all this into storage while they're doing renovations on the tower, they just decided, we're just going to cover in plastic wrap. That's good enough. Okay, so at the library, Trevor shows Amy that all the victims worked on Travis's film. They watch it. It's bad. Amy realizes the film was spliced with Travis's credits. They realize Toby is the one person who worked on the film that has not been killed. So they kidnap Toby and bring in Professor Solomon. Graham is also apparently there, because why not? Trevor pretends to be Travis. Turns out Toby never worked on the film, so Solomon shoots them. We got our killer. Solomon's plan: frame Amy and steal Travis's film. Also turns out Amy's father doomed Solomon's career by not giving him the Hitchcock when he was a film student.
There's a bit here where the Professor Ellis from Die Hard is referring to the fact that Amy will show up, end up in a lesbo prison.
Mm-hmm.
Does he think that all women's prisons are for queer people, or does he just really believe that note that he has forged as well, or like
he has seen enough, like, basically, I feel like all his exposure to prisons is are through movies, so he has only seen The Big Dollhouse and also The Shawshank Redemption.
Have you ever seen Big Fat Liar?
I have not.
So that is a film that came out in, I believe, 2002, possibly 2003. Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes versus Paul Giamatti. Now, in that, the plot of the film is that one day, I forget how, Paul Giamatti is a film producer, like a big time studio, possibly even head. I forget how they get together, but Frankie Muniz ends up in his limo, and then Frankie Muniz leaves after Paul Giamatti has stolen his creative writing project or something, and turns that into a big budget movie, and it's going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
The same movie. This movie is Big Fat Liar.
So here's my, and that also brings up my issue here. So, okay, Professor Solomon kills two actresses that worked on the film. Somebody, the cameraman, a couple people who did other stuff, including effects. And that's it. And he's going to blame that on Amy. And then he's going to steal the film and become successful. He's going to steal the film, win the Hitchcock with it, because the professor apparently can do that.
I don't think that part really is to be come from that. I think that it's more that, like, oh, this is such a good film that anyone in Hollywood will see it and will want me, sort of thing, in the same way that, like, The Spirit of Christmas got South Park made. That's a sort of thing where it's like, oh, this shows such potential, this will become my life from this little taste, despite the fact that he didn't make it.
Here's the problem. Just based off of what we see of the people shooting both Amy's film and the people shooting Toby's film, there's probably more people that worked on this film than the people he killed. Like, we know this for a fact, because at one point, while Travis is editing the film earlier, you hear a male actor who is not Travis. So there's at least one other person that he needed to kill that he didn't. Just, they don't...
Maybe they're off screen.
Maybe they're off screen. Who knows? But anyway around, the problem here is literally his plan falls apart the second he gets to Hollywood, and somebody just know, and literally the one or two people he didn't say anything about are like, hey, that's not his film.
I mean, even if he gets away with it to that point, it's a bad plan to begin with. Like, he's not going to have a long and storied career because, like, I mean, I guess men will continue to fail upwards and, well, continue to get so many second and third and fourth chances, but at least straight white men. I don't know.
I just find it hilarious, though, that also he's a film professor. And he didn't want to ever be a film professor, but apparently he wanted to go to Hollywood and make it big there instead of, you know, making his own film?
I don't know. There are a lot of plot holes there. I do think the end of the film is another, like, there's momentum there, and I think it's well acted, despite the fact that it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Oh, yeah, like... The entire chase sequence that ends up happening here, I really enjoy, because one, they're running through like a couple different scenes, including, you know, the aforementioned sci-fi set, but also just the way it plays with the lighting and everything. After a little struggle, Reese arrives. She tells Amy to drop her gun. Solomon slips up about some details, causing Reese to not trust him. They all...
Sorry. You said Reese too, and then I started thinking reproduction. Sorry.
Anyway.
Thinking of Reese too.
She drops her gun, and then a bunch of other prop guns get dropped, and everyone's trying to find it. Amy does, though, find it, because she remembers the entire thing with the coffee gold-plated gun. Solomon tackles her, gun goes off, he goes down. Later, Trevor accepts Travis's Hitchcock Award, except the PA is going to shoot until Reese shoots him, but it turns out to be part of Amy's film. Only that might have been the film. Solomon lived and is in a mental institute where his nurse is Brenda, the killer from the first film. She wheels him around to the theme from the Alfred Hitchcock Presents as credits roll.
That film doesn't make any sense either. The film that she's making... What... There's so many plot holes there. It's like, okay, so is it it's a movie about this guy winning an award, but you're... So is all the movies that you've made a movie about the movie?
And it's kind of gosh to, you know, and to incorporate in an actual murder into your film, unless the film is about, like, everything that happened in the school, in which case, then is there some kind of urban legend I don't know about a person getting shot at an awards ceremony by a sniper? Was this just, like, the only way that Reese promised, you know, to keep her mouth shut about certain things was, I get to be in your movie?
I doubt that.
Why?
She's a nice person.
And then why is this guy that is not an actor in your movie, multiple people who aren't actors in your movie, except for the fact that nobody wants to be in your movie because they feel like they're going to get murdered, because look at what happened to all the rest of your cast.
I know nothing.
There are just so many issues with this ending, and then apparently it goes on to become an actual movie released, and then goes to TV so that Brenda can show it to Professor Solomon in the crazy house.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just happy we got to see Rebecca Gayhart as Brenda back again.
Yeah. I wish she had more to do.
Yeah, teasing at a sequel that will never happen.
Well, there is a sequel to this film. Well,
a sequel with these two, that will never happen.
So there is another note that I have here that just one of the credits, actually. Special thanks to Fun World. What the hell did Fun World have to do with this movie?
The scary Mac Tonight mask, maybe?
You know what? You're probably right. There were also the masks that Dirk and... Well, the two of them were wearing masks earlier, so that was really it, because there was a Dracula mask and a something else mask.
Yeah.
The scary Mac Tonight mask is very strange. It looks more like a snowman, like an evil snowman mask, but it does have the point. So it's like, yes, that is some sort of moon creature. Which looks also like in being shot in around 99. It's like that's pretty close to the time when Mac Tonight was still like around in commercials. So like, would they have a case for like copyright?
Yeah, honestly, like I think that it's a good final bit, even though literally somehow both Graham and Toby get shot and don't die. Like, they just, they don't do anything after a certain point, so there's no reason for them to have lived.
No. Well, you need Joey Lawrence to be like, hey, I'm still here.
Yeah. I'm her agent.
Yes.
And all the, I mean, I guess that Toby, just because he's the DP on her film, so on Amy's film at the end, so maybe, like, it's so he can get his comeuppance, kinda. I mean, it seems like she's making an action movie, not a horror movie at this point, based off of literally Reese shooting a sniper at the Film Awards.
Well, maybe it's like Twilight Zone, the movie, in that way of when Spielberg couldn't get out of it, he was like, okay, but I'm going to do a happy one.
Fair enough.
And people don't like that segment, but even still.
Anything else before we move on to final thoughts?
I mean, I don't know what you said that I made Twilight Zone the movie one of my final things I talked about, actually, so I wish I had more to talk about, but not really.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like I said, this is a film that I don't hate it. It's not a great film, but it's not a bad film.
And that surprised me when I first rewatched this for the podcast, because the first time I saw this, I liked this more than the first one. And I don't know why, because I still had a good time the two times that I watched it for this, but it's just, there's so many things that need to be polished in this that just weren't.
Yeah, it feels like they needed another pass on the script.
Yeah, definitely.
They needed another pass on the script. They needed to, honestly, they needed to just have a script and stick to it instead of just, okay, we're actually going to completely remove stuff that from it before we even shoot it, remove stuff after we've shot it, because a lot of the stuff that in the deleted scenes, a lot of the stuff that got cut was character establishing moments. And like the problem is this film has way too big of a freaking cast.
Yes.
They're just like, okay. Honestly, what you could easily do to make the a very easy thing, as much as I liked Michael Bacall, just completely merge the character of Stan and Dirk together with just Anthony Anderson handling both of them. There's one less character. Obviously, like, yes, you need to have that scene earlier on because, oh, we forgot to have the killer do something until, like, 20, 30 minutes into our film. But you're also doing it at the expense of establishing the characters that already exist. So what they honestly, if it weren't for the fact that they already shot Sandra's death, you should have just made that, you should have just brought her back and been like, hey, you're dying here instead.
And it's too bad with like, Sandra has such energy, that's where kind of the blurring section happens. Mm-hmm. Because like once she's gone and that kill that is pretty cool happens, it's just like, okay, now we're just gonna spin on a wheel for a bit.
Yeah, and as much
like as much as I enjoy the effects of the stuff that they shot at Ontario Place, I don't think kills there really are very interesting.
Yeah. Like, both of them just get electrocuted. One of them is literally just, oh, my hand is touching a rail. I'm going to touch the rail with an electrical cable, and that's going to shock you to death.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to shove you against the power box. Yeah. Like, honestly, like, if you had just killed off Toby or Graham earlier on in the film, because both of them only exist at this point to be, this is somebody who might be the killer.
I believe Toby in one of the scripts was killed, but I can't recall.
Yeah, because Toby just disappears for, like, a good half of the film. Mm-hmm. Like, the second he's I'm not going to be your DP, he shows up for one more scene to announce, oh, Graham killed himself, and then just gone entirely. Until the point where, oh, we just happen to know where you are driving at this exact time of day so we can go and kidnap you.
Oh, more of a one of the movie theaters that Quentin Tarantino owns in L.A. Has a coffee shop beside it. It is named Pam's Coffee. And it's spelled the way the movie is.
Nice.
Yeah. I had no idea where to put that fun fact, but...
Yeah. Here's as good a place as any.
So, final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically... When it comes down to it, I mean... The film has balls. It's a cheesy sequel. It can barely stick to its own themes. It has way too many characters. But it also just has, like, the balls to, like, invoke Hitchcock and Argento to wildly varying degrees. And yeah. It's... Like, it is, it very much sometimes does feel like a vibes movie. And the other problem, and I barely even talked about this, half the time Jennifer Morrison's character just is reacting. And this is as a person who watched all of Once Upon a Time and enjoyed her character there. Like, she's serviceable in the movie, but eh. I've almost preferred Ava Mendez be the main character.
Well, I don't have any problems with the cast necessarily. I do wish Ava Mendez had more to do, but as I say, apparently she used to have less. So I'm glad she was given more than nothing. Fair. It's also really funny to see Joey Lawrence in a horror.
And I honestly didn't even recognize Joey Lawrence the first time I watched this when I was younger.
Really?
Yeah, well, that's because this came out like maybe 6 years after Blossom.
Well, yes, but Brotherly Love was on for a couple of years, I think, and you can also listen to the Brotherly Love podcast now available on YouTube and other podcast places.
Well, I think it's also the hair.
That's fair. I did watch, not a lot of it, but I did watch some of the Melissa and Joey show, which came out, like, in the early 2010s or so.
Yeah, I'm used to either him with a lot of hair or no hair.
That's fair. Yeah, because on that show, he was bald.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but I did see both Horse Sense and Jumping Ship, and he had about this much hair in those. Those were Disney Channel movies. They're not very good, but they do have his brother, who was TJ on Recess for a few years, in it with him. I believe he's playing his cousin. But, yeah. One is, like, country boy doesn't, or like this city boy doesn't understand this country boy, family member, and they have to work together. And then the second one is like a survival movie with those same characters, and it's very strange the jump that they make with that. But
okay, I'll look into that sometime.
You don't have to.
I probably won't, but still.
Oh, yeah, for my final thoughts, it's okay. I don't know, I enjoy it. As I say, it's not as good as the first movie. I'm not really sure where my head is at the first time I watched both of them. But it's fun, and it has its moments, despite with problems that it has. It's perfectly harmless and has fun vibes. As you said, vibes. Now, would you like to score it?
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm probably going to give it a 3.
3.
Well, have everyone have a happy Halloween. You know, stay safe out there. Yeah, it's about the best I can really tell you at this point.
Happy Halloween!
Urban legend my ass.
Our email address is theshow@earth2.net. That's theshow@earth-2.net. Our voicemail line is 513-EARTH-20. That's 513-327-8420. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we're at Earth_2. That's Earth_2. Please visit the website, www.earth2.net. That's www.earth-2.net. While you're there, on the left-hand side of the page, you'll see a link that says Forums. Click it and join the forums, please. If you enjoy what we're doing and would like to support Earth2.net and Earth2.net the show, there are several things you can do. First, make sure to tell your friends about Earth2.net and all of our podcasts. Second, go to iTunes to leave us positive feedback. Third, you can become a patron of the show by visiting patreon.com/earth_2. That's patreon.com/earth_2. And lastly, donations in any denomination can be made by heading over to paypal.me/earth2. That's paypal.me/earth2. There are no spaces, dashes, or underscores, just Earth and the number 2. Until next time, good night.